Hello there, Matt.
Hey, Bill, how are you?
I'm good. Another edition of the Week in Blog.
Yes,
Always good to talk to you.
Indeed. Good to talk to you.
So I think the hot topic, both in traditional media and blogosphere, were the torture memos that were released by the White House and a increasing uncertainty where the issue goes from here. Even some discussion that Obama felt forced to open up the door to prosecutions because of the blogosphere, because of the intensity on the left on the subject. A few posts that I thought were notable. One in particular, the whole fact that one of the high-level Al-Qaeda members, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was waterboarded 183 times, was actually dug up by a liberal blogger, Marcy Wheeler, part of the Fire Dog Lake Empire, the empty wheel component of that. And the New York Times actually credited her with the scoop. And that's not always something that traditional media does. And Fire Dog Lake gave the reporter Scott Chain some accolades for giving journalistic credit where credit is due. And I think that factoid actually helped further the story. So it started not be a one-day story. It became a multiple-day story to the point where Obama had to face a question about it during his press availability with the King of Jordan. That's where he made the comment that, hey, if the Attorney General is going to prosecute, you know, that's his call. And that led to a whole other round of commentary about it. Beyond that, as far as the actual debate on the subject is concerned, this course kicked around another round of does this work or not?
Right.
And you had Matt Iglesias talking about the best examples that Bush administration defenders can come up with are very weak. You have Steve Bannon at the Washington Monthly pushing back on the notion that Obama's Director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair, actually said that this does work.
Right, and actually I have the conservative blogosphere was abuzz about that. Powerline Scott Johnson, the logical inference is that Obama wants to release information he thinks will smear the Bush administration, but does not want the American public to be fully informed about the benefits that were gained from the Bush administration's policies. We have American Spectator's Phil Klein. This would seem to be an important part of the overall torture debate, but somehow this portion of the memo was conveniently left out by the Obama administration. Ed Morrissey over at Hot Air, in other words, the Obama administration covered up the fact that even their own DNI acknowledges that the interrogations produced actionable and critical information. And I think probably the most the best soundbite or controversial argument, depending on how you look at it, was Eric Erickson at Red State. I do not doubt that more Americans will die at the hands of terrorists under the watch of Barack Obama than under the watch of George W. Bush. So,
and just to clarify here, what are conservatives alleging was covered up?
I think it was that the interrogation techniques banned by the White House, that Obama released the memo, but did not release the Dennis Blair internal documents.
And the other statement that Dennis Blair made, and this is what Steve Bannon was talking about, so that this internal memo, Dennis Blair talks about that they did get high-value information that helped them understand Al-Qaeda better. But Dennis Blair's other statement was, and Bannon points to this, the bottom line is these techniques have hurt our image around the world. The damage they've done to our interests far outweighed whatever benefit they gave us, and they are not essential to our national security. So that seems to be Blair's final conclusion, whatever good stuff did come out of it from Blair's perspective.
There's also an interesting debate in the conservative rightosphere about whether waterboarding is torture. Ed Morrissey, who is always interesting at Hot Air, and he does not come down on the party line all the time. He does not take the sort of standard talking points from anybody. And he says, we need to have an honest debate on interrogation techniques and securing America against attacks. He goes on to say, but conservatives should stop pretending that waterboarding isn't a form of torture that the U.S. has opposed for decades when used abroad especially against our own citizens, but everyone else should stop pretending that it doesn't work and that we would have been safer without its use. So Ed is essentially saying it's a form of torture, but we're safer.
He's just being adamantly pro-torture.
I think he's saying that we're safer because of it, but it is a form of torture.
Points for intellectual honesty.
Let me say, I think Ed Morrissey consistently is an iconoclast, and I say that as a compliment. I think that he says what he thinks is true, and a lot of times people will sing off the same hymnal, you know, or hymn sheet, but not Ed.
Now, I presume that, and may forgive me if I'm being overly cynical of my interpretation, but my sense is that the conservative blogosphere, not to mention Dick Cheney, you know, having a debate over the value of torture probably is not a short-term political winner. It's not the issue that's going to get, you know, it's not going to turn poll numbers around for Republicans right away. My only political speculation is they're saying, hey, if there's going to be another terrorist attack at some point, you know, things can happen to anybody. We want to have a narrative in place that would blame Obama for going soft and not doing, you know, the tough things that the Bush administration did. Do you think that is an underlying motivation to be engaging this debate so vociferously?
I would say that not just on this issue, but I would even say on issues like the economy, I would phrase it a little differently. I would say that whether or not we win today, it's important to go on the record as being in favor of certain things. So, for example, conservatives who voted against the stimulus were going on the record. So I would put it that way. But I think that is an underlying thing, that opinions, public opinions change depending on the circumstances. And I think we'd have to agree that if, God forbid, there were an attack in the near future, that the next day the public opinion polls in terms of this issue would dramatically change. So I don't think anybody's hoping that that happens, but I do think that that's one issue. I think that legitimately a lot of conservatives truly believe that valuable intelligence was gained. The other thing that happened is and Andrew Sullivan today over at The Atlantic had a really good post. Again, let me give him credit for intellectual honesty, taking down Nancy Pelosi, basically proving that Nancy Pelosi had been involved in numerous meetings and had had waterboarding explained to her on several occasions, and her congressional colleagues. And frankly, if anything, they were concerned that we weren't going far enough. And so give Andrew Sullivan, you know, Andrew likes to give out these awards, like the Hugh Hewitt Award. Right. I'm going to give him the Ed Morrissey Award for intellectual honesty.
I'm sure he's touched. I think there have been a lot of upset on the left. I mean, these notions of the, you know, this group of eight that Democrats were involved in. I think there's always been a strain of concern that Democrats were complicit in some of this. I don't think that liberal bloggers have generally looked away from that, although I do note that I think it was Ron Suskin was on MSNBC today. I think he was cutting them a little bit more slack, saying that they were just not in a terribly good position to challenge them, and their hands were tied from going public with stuff. But I think the general tenor of criticism on the left has been to take their shots at Pelosi et al. As well.
Yeah.
The one other related post I wanted to flag was, this goes back to the notion of where does this go from here? Are there going to be prosecutions or not? You know, there's definitely a strong desire in the liberal blogosphere for there to be prosecutions, for people to be held accountable, particularly the architects of the policy. We actually weren't going to get into this later today, but you did mention, you know, should we discuss, you know, why is the left so angry? But this is one of those issues that I think there are folks left that are angry about and don't want to see people left off the hook. Hilzoy, who blogs at I'm going to pronounce it wrong, Obscene Wings, sometimes at the Washington Monthly, but on on Hillsdale's own blog. I'm focused on looking forward to. I see a world, this whole notion that, you know, we should look forward, not backward. Hillsdale says, I also see a world in which everyone takes it for granted that there are two kinds of people as far as the law is concerned. If most people tried to make the case that prosecuting their criminal acts was just looking backwards or a sign that the prosecutor is motivated by a desire for retribution, they'd be laughed out of court. So there's definitely this sense that if you don't want this to happen again, people who did it before have to pay a price. And if you think about other scandals like Watergate or Iran-Contra, where a few people were held accountable and these things seem to keep happening, there's definitely a desire to have accountability.
And I'm trying to find I can't find an example, but there were several conservatives who made the point on the blogosphere that if you're ordered to do something and you're told that the president says to do it and that the attorney general tells you that it's important and legal and important for the country to do, and you do it, and then you're prosecuted later, that is just terribly, terribly difficult on people who are serving this country, you know, in the military and the special forces, and puts them in a very bad position.
I think the momentum is to go after policy architects, not people down the chain who were following orders. And you see Obama essentially ruled out prosecutions against those who were lower in the hierarchy and then cracked open the door with folks who were maybe more involved in designing a policy.
We'll see. I don't think anything like this has ever happened in the history of this country. And what I'm talking about, you know, specifically is I don't think that you've ever had can you think of anything analogous to this?
I can't think of anything analogous for someone who was actually held accountable. I mean, there have been plenty of examples in American history.
You could have put Andrew Jackson in jail.
I mean,
for
Alien Sedition Acts,
to Indians,
Japanese concentration camps. I mean, there's been instances of violations of civil liberties in the American story.
By the way, let me say that here's a thing, and this is something that I'm fascinated by, but I believe the only member, and I may be wrong here, but I tend to remember that the only senator who voted against internment was actually Taft, who was a Senator Taft, mm-hmm. hardcore conservative, and this position, the Bush position on torture, or whatever you want to call it, however you want to define it, this is actually would have been a Democratic position at some points. The old right, the sort of paleocons, the Papbuchanans of the world, they would have hated this. So the traditional, you know, conservatives from like the 1940s would have been completely against this.
The more isolationist conservatives.
Isolationist, in some ways more libertarian, very, very concerned with government.
Government does everything bad, including torture.
Yeah. Exactly. And so that's interesting. And this would have been, you know, 50 years ago, a liberal Democratic, more likely to have been. I mean, FDR was the one who did the internment, obviously.
I'm loath to tar liberalism with the brush.
Well, look, will you admit that, FDR rounded up Japanese and put them in.
Oh, absolutely, and that's part of FDR's record, and he has to take responsibility.
I'm just making the point that I believe Taft, who was, you know, Mr. Republican, who's like the most conservative senator, maybe next to Barry Goldwater or something, was if not the only one of the few who actually stood up and opposed that. And I'm just making the point that these ideologies have gotten all mixed up, haven't they, over the years?
There's always been competing strains in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And, you know, a lot of things got mixed up at the time of FDR, and there's been various shifts, you know, over the course of the last 60 years. I'm not sure that American liberals at the time, on the ideological left at the time, were cheering the concentration camps. I don't think that was necessarily true, but well, obviously it's FDR's record.
Even other stuff with Bush, you know, his Wilsonian inaugural, his you know, and look at how, you know, Kennedy, bear any burden, pay any price. It's interesting, but they want us to talk about what people are blogging about, and I don't think anybody blogged about it, so I probably should apologize and move on.
That's okay.
Off message.
Well, so you were interested in the possible primary challenge that John McCain might face in 2010.
Yes. And it's not just me. This is something that made news yesterday, and several bloggers wrote about it. I was one of them, but let's look at a couple here. Ala Pundit, who is at Hot Air, was looking at Ben Smith from Politico and saying, you know, Ben Smith thinks Simcox, who's challenging John McCain and who was head of this Minutemen militia group, thinks Simcox will be a serious local headache for McCain, but I suspect that depends on how hard the one pushes amnesty this year. If it turns into a sort of galvanizing issue for the base, as it was a couple years ago, the Mavericks in trouble. If not, Eric Erickson went on to essentially say, given the choice between opposing McCain with Simcox in a primary or opposing Arlen Specter with Pat Toomey, I think our money is much better spent beating Specter. I'm paraphrasing, of course. We only have so much money, so many volunteers that we can put in the battlefield. And I believe looking at the demographics of both Arizona and Pennsylvania, it is far, far more likely that Pat Toomey could win the election. So a couple interesting things there.
But there are other conservative bloggers, you mentioned this in a previous segment, that are concerned that Toomey can't win statewide in a general election.
Yeah, that's been something that had been talked about for a couple weeks. We even had the head of the several years ago, the Club for Growth started a few of these local chapters, and they've generally been a headache to them. And the head of the Pennsylvania Club for Growth chapter put out a statement yesterday saying that Toomey shouldn't run, that it'll end up electing a Democrat, and that we should back Specter. So there's a lot of talk about whether or not Toomey should run, but it seems to be that I would take a slight disagreement with Erickson here. Eric Erickson says, I believe looking at the demographics of both Arizona and Pennsylvania, it is far, far more likely that Pat Toomey could win in a general than Chris Simcox. I would disagree. It's not about the demographics of the states. It's about the quality of the candidates, both challengers and incumbents. Pat Toomey is a much, much more credible and serious candidate than Simcox. And I would also say that Arlen Specter
is... Simcox is crazy, correct?
I've never met him. I don't know him, but I do know that I would classify him sort of in the category of, you know, we've had a lot of people who are sort of organizational leaders like Gary Bauer, or a better example is Alan Keyes, organizational activists try to run. I don't lump Toomey in that same category because, number one, the Club for Growth isn't just an organization, they're a juggernaut. And
Toomey was a congressperson, right?
And secondly, he was a member of Congress in Pennsylvania. So he's much more credible, and I think Specter is a lot more vulnerable than McCain is. So it's not demographics as much as it's the quality of the candidates that makes. I think conservatives are willing to coalesce around Toomey. I do not think you will see anybody. Well, I don't say anybody. I don't think there'll be a big conservative movement to back Simcox or to oust McCain unless McCain gets all McCain-y again. So. Which let's hope doesn't
Well,
happen.
What do you think Erickson was getting at there? Is he saying that Arizona is becoming so Latino that putting up a diehard anti-immigrant movement candidate is a sure loser in Arizona?
That's a great question, and I hadn't even thought of that. And I will ask him. You want to get him on the phone right now? I'm curious. My guess is he just. That he was wrong, but maybe not.
I'm only curious because I wondered to what degree the conservative blogosphere is grappling with the changing demographics of the country. Are they starting to think about how do we appeal to non-white voters? Because obviously what we were doing in 2008 sure didn't work.
My only concern with that, though, would be he says that the demographics of Arizona is better than Pennsylvania, or that looking at the demographics of both states, it's far more likely Toomey could win. But Pennsylvania has to be a tougher state than Arizona for a Republican to win, I would think. Maybe I'm wrong.
It's been a bluer state for a longer period of time.
So my guess is that Eric, when he talks about demographics, probably my guess is if we were to talk to him, he was just saying that the various factors involved would favor Toomey. It's more likely dramatically more likely Toomey could oust Specter and win the general election than it is Simcox could win the general election, even if he ousted McCain. I think that's a fair assessment. I think there is a very I think it's entirely plausible that Toomey wins the primary and the general election. I think even if Simcox were to win the primary, there's no way he would win the general.
Now, the other big McCain story this week is this smackdown between Matt Iglesias and Meghan McCain.
Yes, I enjoyed that one because I've written about how vapid and inane Meghan McCain. Let me say this.
So you joined Matt Iglesias on this.
I think Matt Iglesias joins me, but he said it better than I did when he said she's never accomplished anything or held a job, as far as he knows, and to which she fired back with expletives.
She went on a Twitter rampage.
This one's out. She went on a Twitter rampage. But let me say this in defense of Meghan McCain. I think 10 years ago, I might have said some of the same crazy things she's saying now. I think it's a product of immaturity. And I think she thinks she's doing well. And I think she thinks that we're old fuddy-duddies and behind the times. But Matthew Iglesias is right. I mean, she's the Paris Hilton of the right. I mean, what has she ever done? Now, granted, you could say that about a lot of bloggers, but clearly, you know, I just use myself as an example. Obviously, I don't have anywhere near the platform she has. But, I mean, you know, I started off working at a conservative think tank, and you know, I've run campaigns, and I started off, you know, blogging at Human Events Online and then Town Hall. And then you sort of, you know, hopefully if you try, you gain knowledge, and we're all a work in progress. We're always learning. But here she is thrust into this position. And I've always thought, thank God that they didn't have Facebook or MySpace when I was in high school or college, because I would have done really stupid stuff. And there might be naked pictures of me somewhere or whatever, or drinking something other than vitamin water 10. But luckily there weren't, and there wasn't Twitter either. And so I think that I'm glad that I didn't have, you know, the opportunity to make naive, stupid political statements.
Let me take up the Meghan McCain defense. In Iglesias' post, you know, he made sort of an implicit self-deprecating remark to himself, because he's a mass, you know, guy on the blogging scene, essentially at Meghan McCain's age in his early 20s, and managed to...
Yeah. And he's a really nice guy.
And
I
he
like
established a quality reputation for his blogging and his other writing, and landed a book deal very early, and is now a very respected commentator. Meghan McCain now has her book deal after blogging, I think, for considerably less time. But, you know, in my mind, you know, bloggers have always gotten a rap of not having credentials. Why is anybody listening to these people? You know, why they don't have editors? They don't have resumes. What's the point? It's a lot of yibber yabber. But my argument has always been, you know, every blogger stands on his or her own credibility. You know, you don't read blogs in total. You read the bloggers that you like and respect, and you base it on the quality of their individual work. Meghan McCain has, I think, like 25,000 Twitter followers. That's a hell of a lot more than me.
Oh, if her name was Meghan Smith, she would have 10 Twitter followers.
But there are other people in this world that have famous last names.
This is a cult of celebs.
Roger Clinton didn't sell a lot of CDs, you know. Billy Carr didn't sell a lot of beer.
America loves young blonde chicks. You know that. I mean, if one goes missing, MSNBC bumps me to go cover it. I mean, you know that. It's nothing more than this vapid celebrity worship culture we live in.
I mean, I think that's an argument, but...
And look, and you're right. Young bloggers who have... they have to develop credibility. They have to work their way up. And I do think there's an interesting point to be made here, which is every blogger, it's like moving into the neighborhood. You want to be the last one to move in, you know? And then no more people moving into the neighborhood. So I do think that there's some of that, and there may be some jealousy and there may be some resentment. But as conservatives go, our concern is not that she's getting all this publicity because, you know, Sarah Palin gets a lot of publicity, but it's that she essentially is being used as a pawn by the left when she goes and gives speeches and attacks conservatism.
Well, there is a long history of professional contrarians and provocateurs that I would argue don't have a lot of substance behind it. But people, you know, like Andrew Sullivan, like Christopher Hitchens, people who make a practice of doing, you know, Michael Kingsley had a great essay on how Hitchens is constantly being contrarian and getting having and feeling his career that way. But what, you know, what has Christopher Hitchens done? You know, he run a think tank? No, you know, he writes. That's it. That's what a lot of commentators do, and they.
No, but as much as I profoundly disagree with Christopher Hitchens, although I did enjoy watching him get waterboarded, he is a very, very smart man, and he is very intelligent and very well spoken. And God knows if I had a British accent, I'd probably be ruling the world right now because it just sounds so eloquent. But he has very interesting ideas. I happen to disagree with his politics. Meghan McCain has none of that.
Obviously, somebody thinks she does. I mean, it's not solely up to you or I to deem it.
Ashton Kutcher has a million Twitter followers.
Lots of people want to hear what he has
to say. It's not because he's insightful. It's not because he's spurring debate on or intellectual discussion. It's because we live in a celebrity worshiping society. And I mean, look, it's a free market. Let him follow him. I'm just saying.
Apparently, you want some sort of government regulation to muzzle celebrity Twitterers.
You got me. You got.
But, you know, I mean, she has her book deal. And if she can't, you know, write a sentence or can't find a ghostwriter to write a sentence, the book's not going to sell and she's going to fade away. But if she has interesting ideas, then she'll sustain. And, you know, that is the marketplace.
Okay, let's move on.
on to a more substantive issue. We are taping this on.
I'm sure we'll be back talking.
What's
about
that?
At some point. We'll be back talking
course.
About
she's,
at some point.
She's an intellectual force. It is Earth Day. We're taping this on Earth Day. The first serious set of hearings on the House Clean Energy Climate Protection Bill started today. The chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee, Henry Waxman, is trying to get that bill out of his committee by Memorial Day. So this is moving. There's definitely been a lot of chatter in Washington that a carbon cap could not get done anytime soon. But the issue, the train is moving, and I think this has gone in. The issue has gotten attention on the conservative blogosphere for some time as they try to attack this as a giant tax on all Americans. You started to see in the environmental blogosphere this week the beginnings of pushback on that. But I'd note that you're not seeing as much generalist liberal blogger commentary on it because of the great attention on the torture memo. So it's one, and I think this is why President Obama seems somewhat reluctant to deeply engage the issue. The memos got released because his hand was forced by an ACLU lawsuit.
I'm sorry, Bill, is it just me or was Earth Day this year less of a big deal? Now, granted, I was listening to Johnny Cash most of the day on Pandora, so I wasn't watching MSNBC or Fox, but it seems like it was less of a big deal this year.
There's some decline over that over time because I think there's been an increasing sense in the environmental movement that having one day a year doesn't cut it anymore. In fact, grist.org.
Why can't every day be? Why can't every day be?
Well, right. And grist.org actually had a campaign for the last couple of weeks called Screw Earth Day, because every day should be Earth Day, and cordoning it off into a day a year as a symbolic gesture. You know, this notion we're sort of past the symbolism, you know. You know, they had like a light turn off day a couple of weeks ago, you know, when, you know, seasoned environmentalists like, look, there's a bill to get passed here that we actually have to cap this carbon or, you know, all is lost. So let's forget about the symbolic gesture. So I think that has something to do with that. But they did time the hearings to start on Earth Day in hopes of getting more attention to it. I think they got somewhat crowded out by the torture debate. But in the environmental blogosphere, it is capturing attention. You had the EPA release its cost estimates of what this would mean per household. Kate Shepard and Grist summed that up. The EPA estimated on Tuesday that the bill would cost the average U.S. household $98 to $140 a year, or 27 to 38 cents a day, though that didn't stop some Republicans from claiming the bill would wring Americans dry.
Yeah.
There's a
group called the Tax Foundation. They estimate $1,218 per household, and they say that it will be a regressive tax that will disproportionately hit lower income.
Well, there's going to be this numbers debate. As I think you know, conservatives are pushing $3,000 a year, and some still are, even though they're citing this MIT study. The MIT authors say you're misquoting our study. But the Tax Foundation, that is a conservative outfit, if I recall. So my guess is that will be treated in an ideological way. And I'm sure conservatives will treat the EPA in an ideological way, although
yes.
EPA would say this is based on you know, what our career civil servants say. The other study that came out that Brad Johnson at Wonk Room highlighted is the Union of Concerned Scientists, which is definitely a liberal group, but they are scientists, said – Americans can significantly reduce carbon emissions and lower energy bills by implementing the broad green economy legislation after factoring in the clean energy investment, clean vehicles, and global warming standards, that by 2030 net household savings would reach $900 a year. And this is the argument that you're going to see more and more. You can isolate out the increased costs on fossil fuels, higher prices for oil, higher prices for coal. But when you take into account the clean energy investments, how more affordable the clean energy would be, how much less energy you'd have to buy because of energy efficiency technologies, the overall energy bill that people have, in the words of Stephen Chu in the hearing today, the energy secretary said they're looking to keep that constant, he said. And the Union for Concerned Scientists is saying over time this will actually become a net savings. So this is where the debate is going, and I think you're going to see in the conservative blogosphere and liberal blogosphere different numbers going back and forth and people challenging each other's credibilities.
I think you're right. And, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics, and you've got your numbers, we've got our numbers. There were a couple of interesting stories that I noted today that are – along the environmental lines. One, the Huffington Post, talking about the Ed Morrissey Award, goes to the Huffington Post. They had an interesting story. It was a woman who talked about these new light bulbs that we're supposed to get for mm-hmm. the environment. Of course, all of my lighting around here is with those new light bulbs.
And they were fine for you?
But if you they are great. But if you break one, apparently, there's like a 20-step process, according to this HuffPost
article.
Well,
that's a little over. I actually broke one this month, so I could speak to this.
Yeah, it is like a 20-step process, and I think you have to have a PhD to do it.
Having done it, I would disagree. I mean, the thing is, there's a little bit of mercury in these bulbs, so if you do break one...
Well, step one is to open the windows and leave
right,
for 20 minutes.
I literally did this. I broke the bulb in my office. I went online. I went to the EPA site. I saw the steps. Open the windows, left for 20 minutes, and then you essentially you have to sweep it up with a piece of cardboard, get it into a container like a Tupperware or something, and seal it up and put it away. And then there's most communities I think have like a hazardous waste disposal day. You know, in my town, it's I'm going to go next month. So
I'm just going to flush mine down the toilet.
I would not do that.
God forbid.
That would not be helpful.
What could happen? Bill, what could possibly happen? Come on.
So, yeah, there's a little bit of hassle with some of these things. but it's still the net savings you're going to get from your own utility bill costs using these bulbs because they use so much less energy, you know, is worth the occasional hardship of dealing with, you know, the occasional break.
That's debatable. I would rather have the old light bulbs. The other story that was fascinating, it didn't get a ton of blog play. However, Rush read it on his show. The Philadelphia Bulletin wrote a story about Ira Eisenhorn, who, according to some, was a co-originator of Earth Day, co-inventor of Earth Day. Mm-hmm. He may or may not have been, but it's clear he was the MC of the very first Earth Day. He ended up killing his girlfriend, and there were some great lines about how he killed more people than Three Mile Island killed and stuff like that. So it's a sort of a side issue, but it definitely got some play today.
Hmm. Do you know anything about that?
Do you know anything about that guy?
I that's the first I've heard of it.
He killed his girlfriend, and he put her in, like, a footlocker in his house and just left her there. And eventually people caught on for obvious reasons. Wouldn't you take her out? Wouldn't you throw her in the river or, you know? I think that clearly this guy was a bad guy.
Yes. And it does not necessarily mean you should not care about Captain Carbon.
And the headline said he loves Mother Earth, kills girlfriend or something like that. So.
Well, this has been it's long been a conservative tactic. You saw this with Al Gore to try to discredit make the person into some sort of awful caricature.
But we know that Al Gore has killed many, many people.
No, no one ever called Gore a murderer. Clinton, I did hear some of that.
Well, Vince Not Foster, Gore. And the litany is unbelievable. But Al Gore was driving the car.
But the issue is the science, not the unfortunate acts of individuals.
Well, I think both sides are guilty of that. You know, like Rush Limbaugh. Well, Rush Limbaugh is a drug addict, or you know what I mean. Rush makes a statement, and liberals, but you can't listen to Rush because he takes Vicodin or whatever.
Yeah, I think there's some stuff like that that is not helpful or constructive. Mm-hmm. I did think when that happened, if we can get totally off topic here, it was worth attacking Rush for hypocritical things he said about drug crimes.
Right, but I think you could make an argument that, you know, this guy cared so much about saving Mother Earth, but not saving human life. And I think that's
a bastard. I don't like that guy.
It's a common hypocrisy that we could make about, that conservatives often make about liberals, is that they care more about, I don't know, an aardvark than a baby. So.
Let's leave it on that note.
I hate it when you're mad at me, Bill.
What's that?
I'm not gonna. We should never let the sun go down on.
I'm not going to bed angry.
Okay, you still like me?
I do still like you.
Were you? I kept the pug sounds to a minimum today.
Have your pugs made it on camera yet?
No. Next week I'll put them on, and so you got to tune in. And let me give a cheap plug here.
Okay.
My pugs come from the Mid-Atlantic Pug Rescue, and one of my pugs was actually. When I got him completely – well, not when I got him, but when the foster parents got him, he was completely bald because somebody wouldn't spend $50 to get him the medicine to keep – and now he still has a little bald spot. But it's growing in nicely. We've got him Rogaine or something. But this is a great organization, and there's so many pets out there and aardvarks that need our help. So it's the best thing in the world. And, you know, whatever you like beagles, I'm sure there's rescues. But I actually thought Barack Obama should have, and I wrote about this at the time, Don't get a dog from a breeder, but go with these rescues. These dogs are just amazing, and they're loving, and they've been through a lot, so it's cool.
My household was not happy about that decision.
Why is that?
Oh, we were very excited for the president to get a rescue dog, and not ideal that it went with a breeder. It seemed like the Kennedys twisted his arm a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know,
but definitely it would be good to get the word out that there are plenty of animals that need rescuing.
Absolutely, and that's something we'd agree. And you know what? Here's something, Bill. You already have like a goatee, right?
It's a beard. It's a full beard.
See, I'm working on one right now. I can't. People don't realize I can't see you, and you can't see me. But so like I'm unshaven.
I don't know if I want you with a beard.
Here's what I'm challenging you to, or I'm challenging you to consider this. I'm going to call it Mustache May. And what we do is, during the month of May, you have to shave nothing but a mustache, and it'll probably look hideous, but that's part of the fun. And we raise money, and we raise money from our blogs, and $1,000 could go to the Pug Rescue, the Mid-Atlantic Pug Rescue. And whoever gets the $1,000 first gets to shave. The other person has to keep the mustache.
I'm only going to flinch on that because I have a baby coming in June. I don't want the baby to sleep with a mustache in June.
That'll be his or her first okay. Just
I don't really think they got born in the 70s all of a sudden. It's, you know, it's like Lost.
Let's put our heads together. Maybe there's a way we can raise money for a
I'm more than happy to raise money for the shelter.
Maybe next year we do Mustache March or something. It's, you know.
We can go full beard. How would full beard May?
I would go – well, you've already got a beard, though, so it doesn't count.
But I keep it very lightly shaven. I could go clean, and then it just be a beard race.
I don't think that counts if you have a beard. It's not fair.
We'll figure it out. We'll do something.
You know what would be awesome is if commenters would weigh in and give us their thoughts on what we could do to really embarrass ourselves.
Obama, I'm down with that.
Obama's going shirtless. I could go shirtless on a Blogging Heads. You know, there's a million ideas here. So
open up to the commenters.
That's rock and roll commenters, and give me heck for my right wing brown shirt stances while you're at it. So I know you will. I know you will.
You got fans there.
They love me on the comment section. I'm Jim Morris, the Jim Morrison of comments.
So. That's a good note to end on.
All right, Bill. Good talking to you, man. And we'll see
Same
you next
you.
Week. All right.
Excellent.
Bye bye.
Take care.